We come to this place for magic. We come to the Blatcast to laugh, to cry, occasionally be revolted, to pretend that you care. Because we need that, all of us. That indescribable feeling we get when the sound begins to prematurely dim, preserving that sacred runtime that is always measured in full minutes. And we go somewhere we've never been before. Not just entertained, but somehow reborn. Together. From musician interviews and unique movie reactions to stories about getting tossed off the Groove Cruise and rescued by the Canadian CIA. Dazzling conversation on tiny earbuds that repeatedly fall out, or a huge pair of Beats by Dre that never fit, but you spent $200 on them, so you wear them anyway. Sound we all can feel. Somehow, heartbreak feels good in a place like this. Our hosts feel like the best part of us, and stories feel perfect and powerful. If you feel like you're part of the episode, it's because here, you are. The Blatcast. We make podcasts better.
This is the Blatcast, an occasionally fast-paced but usually laborious and ponderous look at the world, hosted by Christian Blatt. Now sit back and get ready to be entertained by a show that clearly doesn't understand math, where an hour can last 176 minutes. And now, here's Christian Blatt.
Welcome to the Blatcast. As always, I'm Christian Blatt, and please like, subscribe on YouTube and your favorite podcast app. Just look for B-L-A-D-T-C-A-S-T. Very excited to start off the show today with Ricky Medlock. He has a great new song with his Ricky Medlock band called Never Run Out of Road. We're going to talk about that, talk about some of the importance of the message. But Ricky, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today.
Hey, listen, I appreciate you having me. It's an honor.
Well, I can't wait to talk to you about Never Run Out of Road. But I know obviously a lot of people know you from Blackfoot, but I think we have to start off talking about how not only are you a part of Lynyrd Skynyrd today, but you're actually an original member of the band. I think it's a nice little sort of footnote because, you were a part of the band for a couple years in, 71 and 72, right?
Yeah, that is correct. I actually joined them early on in 71. And at the time that I joined, they were already working on enough material to be able to record their first record in Muscle Shoals, Alabama, at 3614, the old one,
Yeah.
When I got in the band, they had already told me, Ronnie did. It was so funny. I was up in New Jersey, living up in New Jersey with the early on versions of Blackfoot. And so what happened was that I kind of got, a little disheartened with the way things were going in the band, and things weren't going along quite the way I'd like to have seen them go. So I happened to get a hold of Alan Collins, and Alan says, do you still play drums? And I said, well, as a matter of fact, I do. He said, you need to call Ronnie. So he gave me his number. I called Ronnie, and Ronnie answered the phone. And I said, hey, is Ronnie there? He goes, this is Ronnie. He goes, who is this? I said, this is Ricky Medlock. He goes, Ricky, how in the world are you? I said, I'm okay, man. I just called Alan. He said that you guys might need a drummer. And I said, I still play drums. I went, what's up? He goes, well, we're going to be starting our first record in Muscle Shoals, Alabama. And he goes, we need a drummer because Bob Burns, the guy that was the very first drummer there, he goes that Bob is leaving the band due to personal reasons and stuff. And I went, well, I'm your guy. And they sent me an airline ticket, make a long story short, sent me an airline ticket. I flew down to Jacksonville. And the afternoon I landed there that night, we were working on the material that would later become Lynyrd Skynyrd's First and Last, and also the big box set that's the Muscle Shoals collection.
Right. So you have that stretch, you know, collaborating with everybody in the band. And I think it's interesting that there's a bit of a break there. Obviously, you go back to doing stuff with Blackfoot, which I think is probably where a lot of people associate your name. And it's about 25 years later, Gary Rossington says, hey, can you come help us out as a guitarist? And you've been there ever since. It's a bit of a long pause for being in a band, you know, 25 year hiatus, as it were, Ricky.
Well, I had gotten invited to Freebird, the movie premiere in Atlanta, Georgia, which took place at the Fox Theater. And I was invited by Ronnie's widow, Judy Van Zandt. And she said, we're going to be doing this premiere of the movie. And she goes, the night before, there's going to be an all-star jam. And I was like, oh, man, you know. She goes, why don't you come take part in the All-Star Jam, and you take part in the premiere. I know that the guys would love to see you. And so I said, great. So I loaded up. My manager and I did. We drove up to Atlanta from Fort Myers, Florida, and got up there. Sure enough, I went to the rehearsals that day, saw everybody. And that night of the jam, I ended up joining Johnny and the rest of the guys on stage, and I sang with Johnny on I Ain't the One. And then I actually ended up doing Train Train, but shortly after that, Charlie Daniels goes out and he said, he said, Ricky, he said, you got time to do another song? Do you want to do another song? And I said, well, sure, but the band hasn't worked on anything else with me. Can I do it just right by myself? He said, of course. So I grabbed an acoustic guitar, walked out onto the Fox Theater stage, got a huge ovation, which really surprised me and overwhelmed me at the time. And I went out there and I played Highway Song right by myself on acoustic guitar. Well, while I was doing that, Skinner's management said to my manager, we need to put Ricky back in this band, into Skinner. Gary's been talking about it for the last several years. And I was surprised to hear that. And because he had some, you know, he had some fine musicians in the band. But I think what had happened was that they were kind of trying to do this country thing, and it wasn't working out. And so when Gary got a hold of me, he called me up about a couple of months later in March. And he says, I'll never forget this, man. This is so cool. I had one of these old, you remember back then we had answering machines that had tapes
sure,
in it.
Sure, yeah. You'd put an actual, the same kind of cassette you might listen to an album on, went right into the machine. Sure thing. Yeah,
exactly, man. So I was at home and, or I was at the studio, a studio that we had built in Fort Myers. And I said, well, let me call the house and see if there's any messages. And kind of had forgotten about, you know, what was going on. I was going about writing songs for myself and thinking about recording more and, you know. So all of a sudden there was this message that said, hey, Brother Ricky, this is Gary. I'm going to come down to Fort Myers. I want you to learn I Ain't the One, Saturday Night Special, That Smell, and Freebird. And I'm going to come down and I'm going to audition you. And if you pass the audition, I'll give you $1.50 in a Snickers bar. I thought to myself, well, okay. So I learned pretty well the songs. Learned them all. And he wanted me to do, basically, he wanted me to do Alan's parts. And I promised him, I said, look, since Alan's style and my style was so similar, I got this. I got this handled. So I went about learning all of Alan's rhythms and leads. And Gary came in, sat down with me. And I had a CD player there with my Firebird and CD of I Ain't the One all queued up. I hit it. I played right through the lead. And as I went out of the lead back into the last verse, he reached over and turned it off. And I thought to myself, uh-oh, you know, he goes, man, that was great. He said, that was note for note. He goes, you want to do this? And I went, damn right, I want to do it. Let's do it. He goes, let's call Johnny. So we called Johnny, and he put Johnny on the phone with me. And Johnny said, you know, Ricky, you've always been a lead singer, lead guitar player. He goes, are you sure you just want to play guitar, you know, and be there? I said, Johnny, look, my granddaddy Shorty told me, if you can never ride in the back seat of a Cadillac, you'll never get to be the driver. I said, I'm in the back seat now.
Yeah, look, and I mean, it's like, it's almost like, oh, do you want to sign with a championship ball club where all you're going to do is pinch hit? Well, like, well, yeah, because right. I want to contribute in the way. And right. I think that makes sense. And yeah. Yeah, seems like it's a great opportunity. And, you know, it's been basically 25 years since then. And I know Gary passed away last year, but I know that Skinner is, of course, still out there. You know, as I was preparing to talk to you, I was like, oh, maybe I'll mention, you know, some of the dates. There's so many dates. Everybody should just go to leonardskinner.com if that's what they're looking for. It's great to see, you know, some bands slow down, 50 years in, but not Skinner.
After being collectively in the band, I mean, I was in the band 2.5, going on 3 years, and now I've been back in the band 28 years.
Okay.
I looked at it and I go, wow. You know, I've been in this band collectively over 30 years. And it's pretty amazing, man, when I think about it, what a ride, you know. And I feel very blessed and fortunate that I've been able to be in actually two really great Southern rock bands, you know. A lot of people never get a chance to be in one. So yeah. I feel very, like I said, I feel very blessed and fortunate that I'm sitting here talking to you. And things are going great.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk about the new song in a second. But as you're talking about, you know, Skinner, you know, the idea that, you know, you're fortunate to have been in two great bands. Skinner obviously has an amazing catalog filled with, you know, some of the greatest songs that you'll hear on classic rock or wherever. But there's two that, of course, stand out. You know, if for some reason the house lights come back on and you know, Skinner hasn't done Sweet Home Alabama or Freebird, people are probably going to rip the seats out. So even all this time with the band, talk about sort of that moment when, you know, the opening notes of one of those two songs start. I'm sure people are into the show the whole time, but talk about sort of the transformation the crowd goes into when it's like, oh yeah, this is what we're here for.
Well, you know what we try to do is every year, we try to put there's so many incredible Leonard Skinner songs that every year it's almost, you know, it's hard to pick a precise set.
Sure.
So you got to start, you know what you're going to end with. So you start at the end and you kind of work your way to the middle. Then you start at the beginning and work your way to the middle. And hopefully you've come out with the best set that you could possibly do. This year, however, we're actually doing a couple of songs we haven't done in quite a while. And you know what? It's this show this year is doing really, really good. We've got, you know, of course, ZZ Top is out on the road with us. We're calling it the Sharp Dress Simple Man Tour.
I love it.
plus Blackstone Cherry's out with us opening the show. And you know what, man? We've had great crowds. We're doing great business, and you know what? We couldn't be happier right now at the way things are turning out. So for me, being able to do this every year and seeing the fans, I mean, before Gary passed away, I will tell you that, you know, it was his intention and his wishes, you know, that the music never faded away and the brand name just never kind of went by the wayside the way a lot of bands do. And so when he passed, you know, Johnny and I, you know, had the decision of, well, what do we do now, you know? But we knew Gary wished that. So yeah, we went through all the normal things that you got to go through business-wise. And we came out on the end, and here we are. We're Lynyrd Skynyrd, and we are Lynyrd Skynyrd, contrary to what people might want to say or, you know, believe or whatever. But the band is the band. And you know what? We're going to take this thing on. I mean, as long as we can take it on. The way I look at it is if the Rolling Stones could do it, we can do it, you know?
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, you know, the Stones are, you know, basically creeping in on 60 years, and I'm going to see them in July. You know, I have my tickets already. You know, and there's no reason to stop. People want to, you know, come and see, and it's really it's about the songs and being able to share them with the crowds, and I can only imagine that they're, you know, just as feverish as they were, you know, basically 50 years ago. I do want to take time to talk about Never Run Out of Road, which is a great new song that you have out with the Ricky Medlock Band. And it was released by Rock the Cause, which I want to take a quick moment and explain that it's like a community-focused nonprofit organization. And in their history, they've sold over 500,000 singles, 50,000 digital physical records, and their songs have been streamed 40 million times, just to sort of, you know, partner with charitable organizations. In your case, for Never Run Out of Road, the resources are to provide funding for missing and murdered Indigenous women, specifically that movement. So let's start with the song and then kind of, you know, back out and talk about, you know, partnering with the MMIW organization.
Sure thing.
So our audio audience will get to hear the song. And unfortunately, on YouTube, Ricky, even though it's your song and I'm talking to you right now, if I played the song, I'd get little red flag notices from YouTube like, hey, you don't own that song. And I'm like, yeah, but that's the guys. So our audio audience will get to hear some of it. But talk about you know, tackling the song and you know, these issues.
Well, it kind of all started many years ago. You know, when I became aware of, you know, this epidemic that you might want to call it, because it really is. It's been going on for decade after decade after decades, of where a lot of your native children, native girls, even boys, middle-aged women, young women, older women from the reservations and all walks of life, they've disappeared, have been found deceased, fearful of trafficking. And as a matter of fact, I tried to do a television series about just that. And we had, it looked like we had the subsidy to be able to do it, was being subsidized. And lo and behold, no network would touch it. Nobody wanted to hear about it. Nobody wanted to talk about it. You know, it was one of those things that, you know, to me, that they felt like, it's just natives, you know, it's not important. So I have been, to the point I have been outspoken about it and upset about it, as anybody should be. So what happened was, is that when we did this song, my friend Mark Warple, who is in the band and part writer with me, he came down to Florida to listen to a bunch of material. Well, I had decided to do a band with him again. And he already had a band going. And I thought to myself, I got a great idea, Mark. I want to interject myself into your band. We can call it, at that time, we can call it whatever. But interject myself into the band. Well, we knew it was going to be a difficult sell just on its own without something to go out and promote. We had to go promote we felt like we had to go promote a new song. So we got busy listening to all this material that I had there at my studio in Florida. And we hit upon this one. Well, we finished it. It was also co-written by Charlie Starr, who is the lead singer, lead guitar player of Blackberry Smoke. And so we finished it off and we put it out. Well, in comes Scott Harold, the owner, I guess you should say CEO of Rock Calls Records, wanted to sign it and, you know, explain to us, you know, this is what I do. I find out, you know, what charitable source that people really want to donate to, and I go after that. Well, it hit me then, bingo. I wanted to pick, you know, something of worth, and called a friend of mine. His name is Gil Birmingham. He's the actor in Yellowstone. He's the tribal chairman there for the tribe that Yellowstone sits on. And so I called him up and I asked him, because they had one of their episodes about this. And I called him up and asked him, you know, do you know a good reputable charity to be able to donate to for the MMIW? And he said, let me call Taylor Sheridan, because Taylor, he donates to this organization that's directly involved with that. So he called him. He got back to me, Gil did, and said that he donates to the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center. So that was our first people. That was our first, you know, organization that we chose to donate to. My second one was Dreamcatchers Charitable Fund out of Canada, which deals with artists or Native people of all walks of life, whether they be teachers, doctors, attorneys like law, artists, musicians, whatever walk of life, this fund is set up for them. And then we, the National Wolves organization, you know, the donation to Saving the Wolves, you know, of North America, that's on there too. But the main one is for the NWIRC. And I urge everybody, you can go on my website, rickymedlock.com, and you can look at the three. They're right there. You click on them, and it'll tell you how to make whatever sizable donation you would like. And if you do, I thank you. I thank you from the bottom of my heart. I really do.
Right. And I know that the proceeds from the song are, of course, going to those charities. And the song itself, obviously, you had mentioned Charlie Starr from Blackberry Smoke, but also some friends of yours from Skynyrd and Blackfoot. And, yeah. You know, so it's a nice representation. And, you know, look, at the end of the day, it also helps. It is a great song. You know, it's to do a charity event for a song, you know, have a song be for a charitable cause. You want people to want the song and go out and get the song. And it seems like rickymedlock.com is a great spot to go and make sure that they're able to find out more about it. And yeah, bring attention to, of course, people are well aware of, you know, the problem of human trafficking. But I think when you're able to shine a little bit more of a light on, you know, here's an aspect of it that I think most people don't think of, I'm sure that that's great. And I hope that the song is the success that that, you know, the cause deserves, and that people are able to find it basically wherever you find music, right, Ricky? You know, it's
on every of your any of your favorite platforms to go to, whether it be, you know, my website or YouTube or Spotify or Apple Tunes, wherever you can find it.
Right, exactly. And, you know, it's it used to be telling people to go out to their record store and buy a 45 or a cassette single or a CD single. Now you don't have to leave your house. You can get it. You know, it just shows up right here, you know. So
I remember those days. I'm telling you.
Yeah. Hey, I still have some singles that that I know and love. They're near and dear to my heart. So you know, that's it's great that we got a chance to chat. And I do hope everybody goes to RickyMedlock.com and check out Skinnerd, because wherever you are, they're going to be around your way before too long. And I'm always glad to see when bands are still out there giving the people, you know, what they want, you know. And Ricky, thank you so much for taking the time. And as I mentioned, the song is Never Run Out of Road. You can find it, as Ricky said, wherever you find your music. And of course, Ricky Medlock, and there's an E on the end of that, RickyMedlock.com. And as I mentioned, our audio audience will get to hear a little bit of the song, and our YouTube audience, just type it in the little window right there and you'll be able to watch, you know, the song's on YouTube too. It's literally everywhere. Ricky, thank you for taking the time. I really appreciate it. And hopefully we get a chance to chat again soon.
Thank you very much, my friend. We'll see you and have safety.
All right. Thanks again, Ricky Bye-bye. Medlock. Great to get a chance to chat with him today. And as I mentioned, our audio audience will get to hear it right now.
I've got my reasons for moving up. And I never run out of road. I've got good reasons. And I never run out of road. To the good Lord, please me home. To the good Lord, please me home. And I never run out of road. To the good Lord, please me home.
Joining me now is Peter, and I know we just talked about it, and you told me how to pronounce your last name, and I'm like, I think I got it. Is it our no, I'm not even going to try. Go ahead and tell me one more time your last name, Peter.
I forgot now. It's been
I made you forget it.
Exactly. Argyropoulos.
Argyropoulos. See, I was going to go hard G, so I knew I was wrong. Argyropoulos.
Well, in all fairness, if we were in Greece, you would say you would use a hard G. You'd say Argyropoulos. Argyropoulos.
Right. And yeah, I'm not good at rolling the G there. And, you know, interestingly enough, this isn't what we were planning on talking about today, but my wife and I honeymooned in Greece, and I didn't even try to pronounce anything. It was just it was all tourist cities. You know, I'd point to the menu, I'd say it, but I was like, I hope it doesn't hurt your ears when I try and pronounce these words.
Well, they're pretty friendly over there. But
you were very friendly. Yeah.
Fortunate to go many, many times because my family's still there. And yeah, they don't mind.
Right. Exactly. So Peter is from Sons of Silver. Their debut album, Runaway Emotions, it's now available, has a great song called Tell Me This. Peter, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today.
Thank you, Christian, for taking the time to chat with me.
Absolutely. So whenever I talk to a musician, I always like to ask a little bit. I always like to start with their earliest musical influences. Did you grow up in a particularly musical household?
I did. Both my parents were musicians. My father was a guitarist, played bass. My mom, a lead singer, played some keys. And they had a band touring Southern California, actually up and down the West Coast. And as rumor has it, my mom, where they played a show, their final show, while my mom was still pregnant with me, well into her eighth month of pregnancy. So
wow.
I guess you could say my first gig was the troubadour. So I grew up around that. And even when my parents, unfortunately, were divorced a few years later, my stepfather was an audiophile as well as a musician. And so I grew around music nonstop.
So what are some of your earliest memories of, you know, especially when music's on all the time? Do you remember like some of the stuff like, oh, hey, what is that? I really like it. You know, you probably take it all in. But what were the things that started to stand out that you were really into?
Well, you know, my parents came from the 60s and 70s. So, you know, obviously Beatles, Stones,
sure.
You know, a lot of folk music at the time, Bob Dylan, you know, when I was really young. But then as I, you know, was starting to come of age. Actually, my dad started taking me to concerts when I was a little kid. Took me to U2, Bruce Springsteen, introduced me a lot of different artists like that, you know, of in the 80s and and the likes of that. So
it's interesting to think about taking a kid to see Springsteen, because the concert would start well before your bedtime and then just end hours after your bedtime, you know?
Oh yeah. No, there were actually, because we went, you know, fairly regularly or frequently. There were a number of times where I remember actually almost passing out at in his arms, and he's like, "Oh, let's go." I'm like, no. Oh, five more minutes, Papa. Five more minutes.
No. Bruce still has two more encores. Come on, exactly. I can do it.
I wonder if I have no recollection. I was too young, but I wonder if we actually made it through some of those.
Yeah, no, that's very cool to, you know, just get sort of taken to those things. Now, you know, it's always interesting when people get brought to shows. What was the first time where you were like, "Oh, I want to go to that show," whether you paid for it or not? Was it like, "This is the show I need to go to," or had you just been to so many that it was like, "I think I go to every show," you know?
Well, there was a bit of that. I would go to pretty much anything, you know, I could get a ticket in my hands on. So, gosh, that's, you know what? I got to tell you, I've been asked many, many questions over the last few years, and that's one I haven't been asked. I can't remember. I have to really think about that for a second. I'm thinking concerts here, not yeah, just like a club show.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, obviously it could be, you know, it could be an arena, you know. You said you grew up in Southern California, so yeah. I assume, yeah, I grew up in the New York area. I've lived in LA for 20 years, but you just realize when you talk to people who grow up in other parts of the country, it was like, "Oh yeah, we'd get two shows a year and I would go to both of them." You know, it didn't matter who it was. Yeah. And so it's always kind of an interesting, you know, when you have so many choices, you know?
No, it's totally true. That's a great question. I would have to say one that I actually went out of my way and chose, I think it may have been Prince.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
I think it was a Prince show. Okay. In this case, it wasn't even that I chose. It was my best friend and I were dating a couple girls and who were friends, and one of them, yeah, their parents got them the tickets, you know? And so they hooked us up. Parents took us to the show. That's probably one I remember. Later than that, though, or, you know, maybe another U2 show. Gosh. Oh, yeah. No, I'm really going to be racking my brain for the rest of the call here. Wait a minute.
Yeah, I know. I've got I've got some envelopes of old ticket stubs, so that
yeah. How about you?
My audience has heard, but I'm always happy to tell sort of a very interesting first run of shows. So in March of 1990, I went to what was one of the locations of the Ritz in New York City. It had been Studio 54 some years before that. And I saw Alice Cooper. That was my first concert that I ever saw. And then that summer, at the local fairgrounds near where I grew up, I saw in the same week, like 2 days apart, I saw Kiss and then Aerosmith. Aerosmith was on the Pump tour. And then I saw Whitesnake with Steve Vai that summer. So there's a point after that where I'm like, "Oh, wait, not every single concert is just this amazing, huge stage show," you know, right? especially with Alice Cooper. It's all like, you know, he's telling stories, he's getting his head cut off, and then he comes back to life, you know, and I'm just like, "Oh, some bands are kind of boring, aren't they?"
Yeah, it's like these guys just go get up there and play. They don't have the whole theatrics behind it. You know, it's interesting. If I may, you mentioned Kiss, because a few years ago I had the opportunity to meet Paul Stanley, and we sat and talked for a couple hours. Actually, a nice, very nice guy, and he was telling me about how in the early '70s, late '60s, early '70s. All the concerts he would see for $2, $3, $4, and he was just running down the list. I mean, it was Zeppelin, Who, you name it. He saw so many acts, and he was reminiscing a bit on how fortunate he was, as well as unfortunate, you know, a lot of the younger folks are today, or even, you know, for the last probably 20 years here, where ticket prices are so crazy that is, a 12, 14, 16 year old. Unless you're really fortunate, it's just not going to happen that you'll get to, more than one or two of those a year. I think about that, because that must have been really inspiring to see all those shows from those great artists. Also, at arenas that, you know, generally weren't that huge, maybe 2, 3, 5,000 would be really big.
Yeah, right. So. Exactly. Yeah, it is very, it is sort of an interesting thing to think about, in the sense, you know, that you get to sort of see all these shows. And, you know, Paul, I read his book and I know that, you know, it was a lot of like, you know, even when he was a little older driving a taxi, it was like he'd park the taxi and go to the garden and, you know, get a ticket for just a couple bucks. That's and right. see all of that. Yeah. And so while I was, let me see if I can find what I was looking for. Sorry. But, you know, and I know from I was lucky enough to meet Paul once, a radio show I was a part of. We had him in studio and I just talked to him for a few minutes during the break. You know, very down to earth guy. And more than anything, yeah, just loves to talk about music. You know, I mean, I know like Humble Pie is like the band that he will talk about that, you know, most people don't talk about in the same breath as like Zeppelin. But I think Steve Marriott, the singer, was a huge influence on Paul from everything that it sounds like, you know, that that's what it was. What I was fidgeting around trying to find, because I use these on a past show, I actually have, for our visual audience, I have the tickets to the two concerts I'm talking about. You can see June 17th, 1990, I saw Kiss, and then 2 days later, Aerosmith. The Aerosmith ticket was a whopping $20, but Kiss was a bit of a steal for $15. And like the charges on tickets now aren't even $20, you know?
No, I was going to say, yeah, the charges and the taxes are going to be, you know, at least.
Yeah. Like I'm planning on going to see Extreme next week. They're doing a show at a theater in LA and the ticket's $49.50. I'm like, that's a great price. When you actually go to buy it, it's $70. I'm like, what? What happened? And, you know, look, I know it's been that way for a while, but, you know, it's, but, you know, even like club shows being $50, they're, you know, when I was in college, you know, club shows were still like maybe $25.
Max.
And, yeah. And t-shirts always hovered around $25 for a while. Maybe not at Kiss shows, but you know what, other shows that now it's like 50. I'm like, oh man, I like this band. But I don't know if I like them enough to spend $50 on a t-shirt. I'd rather buy some of their music for $50. But
you know, that's a great point. Yeah, especially if they have you know vinyl or CDs and
yeah,
that's a good.
Well, I hope Sons of Silver aren't selling their t-shirts for $50, Peter. I'd be embarrassed if you were like, actually, our shirts are $55.
So. Ours are $49.95.
Oh, see, that's a good deal. Yeah, that's all right.
We're very fair.
I get change back from my 50. That's exactly all that really matters.
Well, not all of it. There are, you know, other fees. Oh,
that's true. There's a transaction fee. There's a venue fee.
No, it's I got to tell you, it's because we do our merch through one of those on-demand printing services. Yeah, yeah. And it's to price it under $20 is nearly impossible unless your volume is massive. I mean, thousands of pieces, which we're not. At least while we're not on the road. So it's tough to get stuff for $20, you know, but,
I mean, obviously the goal is to more than just break even, you know, but at the same time, there's a price tag where it's like, all right, I guess we're just not doing t-shirts on this tour because, you know, you can only ask people to spend so much, you know.
It's true. And then you you have to have merch, you know, merch people selling this. If you have transport, you have all like that. It's just everything, as we all know, is much more expensive these days. And the people who get hurt are anyone who's not loaded. I mean, frankly, you know, even then I have friends who are, you know, and they'll be like, God, I just went and did XYZ, went to a concert with my wife or my kid, and we spent like $500, you know, just to get in the door and get one t-shirt each, you know. So
yeah. Well, if, you know, $500, you could, it depends on the venue. If it's the football stadium in LA, it's $500 to park, depending on how close you want to park.
Oh,
you know?
Oh. Yeah. My dad and I saw McCartney about a year ago.
Yeah. I was at that show. Yeah.
Okay. We were invited as guests.
I was not.
it was a corporate thing, and so we actually were like, you know, it's SoFi Stadium. Okay, let's go. And I mean, you're sitting there with your binoculars, you know.
Yeah.
And we were asking what the ticket prices were had we had to pay, and we're like, no way, no, not a chance.
I had seats that are similar to what you're talking about. You know, we didn't bring the binoculars, but we should have. And I think it was like $400 a ticket, you know? Yeah. And there's definitely that moment where like, ah, do I really want to do it? And you know, we'd seen Paul like 10 years ago. And then there was a show that we just didn't go to. And I'm like, well, how many more of these are there? You know?
Yeah.
You know? So yeah,
that's true too.
We'll make up for it though, because we're going to see the Stones this summer, and they do this thing on the day that they go on sale. This they call it the Lucky Dip ticket, where it's like $40, but you don't know where you're going to sit. So you could be in the pit, but probably you're going to be in the nosebleeds. But even the nosebleeds for that show are like $200. So it's like you just kind of roll the dice. The whole point is you can't resell it. It has to be the credit card that you bought it with. So we'll see how it goes. So that sort of will even out a little bit with that McCartney show.
Fingers crossed for you on that one.
Thank you. Yeah. I saw the Stones a couple of years ago. I was in Vegas with my dad, and he had never seen them. He's in his early 70s. And he was like, no, I was... when he had driven cross country, he and his friends were going to go in California. The show that he decided to skip turned out to be Altamont. So I'm yeah, it's probably all right that you didn't go to that one. But exactly. there might have been some chances to see them.
You know, it's funny on that note, just talking to Stones, is Brina, my wife, our keyboardist, her dad was, you know, as unfortunately, he passed away a year ago. You know, as we always got to know each other over the years, I always saw him as a folk rock guy, because that's, you know, folk music guy. That's what he was always playing around the house, his house. And, you know, one day he reveals a bit of his vinyl collection. He has a bunch of rock and roll, especially Stones. He had nearly every Stones album in there. And I was like, huh, you like the Stones? It's like, oh, yeah, saw them many times. Like, really? Where did you see the Stones? He's like, well, I saw them at the Palladium when they played the Palladium, and I think it was 72, 73. It was the Exile on Main Street album. I'm like, come on. He's like, yeah, they played for like 2-3 nights or something like that. I saw them every night. It really pulls out the ticket stubs. I said, well, where were you? He said, I was right up front. So one show I was right up on the stage, another show like 5-10 persons back. I'm like, are you kidding me? So, and I was like, well, how much are tickets? So we looked at ticket stubs. I think it was like a few dollars for a ticket.
Oh, yeah.
It was something crazy.
Yeah. A lot of times you'll see shows, especially from them, you know, and they're held in like auditoriums and things that aren't designed for concerts. And it's like, it's like $4 on the day of, $3 the day before, you know, if you buy it in advance or whatever. Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy. It's always interesting. I just like to use the example that, my mom would always tell me the story that she and her friends, when they were in high school, they went to see the Monkees, and they hated the guy who opened, who was playing the guitar with his feet, who of course was Jimi Hendrix. And I just love the idea. Yeah. So I love the idea that, and look, I get it. You know, you're there to see, see the guys in the Monkees. And I don't know how long he opened for them, but yeah, they went to some like auditorium in New Jersey. And it's just so funny to be like, oh yeah, I saw Hendrix. But yeah, I wasn't really into it, but
you know, it's funny on that. I have another one from another parent one, right? So my dad has this one where one of his friends calls him up one night and says, "Hey, we're going out. We're going to go see Ricky Nelson at the Roxy." You know, and for those who don't know, Roxy's on the Sunset Strip, well-known club. You know, capacity is what, 500, 600?
Yeah, maybe? I think it's about 500. Yeah.
And it was a table night, so probably even fewer that night. So he's like, oh, Ricky Nelson, not my thing. Like, come on. It's like, it's fun. Like, okay, I'll go. And there was one opening act. He said like a acoustic duet. And then another guy walks on stage and he walks out playing a banjo, and they're like, it's pretty good, but it's strange because he has an arrow coming out of both sides of his head. And then they're looking at it, they can't quite figure out. They're like, this guy is. He's a mean banjo player. This guy can really play, and he sings well too, but his music is odd. You know, turns out it was Steve Martin. Yeah. And they said he destroyed Ricky Nelson. You know, Ricky Nelson comes on next. And plus, in my dad's case, he wasn't necessarily a huge fan. Right, and this was well into the 70s. So I'm sure by then Ricky Nelson's music wasn't as, you know, relevant maybe. Yeah. And he said, I'll never forget though, because this guy, they eventually obviously figured out that he was a comedian, and this is before he blew up, and they were just dying. He said they were like, no, please don't leave the stage, the whole audience.
Yeah, no, I mean, I've heard some of the old Steve Martin albums, and he comes out and he does that Ramblin' Man song, like on the banjo. So I can see just like
probably what it was.
Who's this dude in the white suit? Yeah. Okay, wow, he actually can really play. And yeah, and I love that he still tours with his banjo act. You know, the Steep Canyon Rangers. Like he's really committed to the
didn't
banjo.
Didn't they win a Grammy a while back?
I think they did. Yeah. And yeah, it's like he'll go out and do a tour with like Martin Short, and then he'll also do like a banjo tour as well. And it's like, that's, you know, it's got to be I don't know, to be so good at multiple things. You know what I mean?
Yes, it's
crazy that he incorporated the banjo into it. So I do want to talk about your band. Obviously, we could talk about all this kind of stuff forever.
Why?
Because I want people to know about Sons of Silver. But the final thought that I have is, you're talking about, you know, sort of my dad also had a great record collection. And, you know, for younger people in the audience, it wasn't as easy and like, oh, I want to hear this album. You know, you had to go and buy it. And maybe on classic rock radio, you'd hear some songs from it. But yeah, he had like, you know, the Six Doors albums, all the Beatles albums. He had all the Stones albums right up until 1972. His record collection stopped very abruptly when he got married and started having kids, but it was really extensive from like 66 to like 74, you know?
That's awesome.
And and then I, you know, was able to find some of myself. But yeah, so it was like, you know, he had them on vinyl. So like I recorded them all on cassettes and would listen to them in my room. And it was like, you know, save myself even in those days, like, you know, thousands of dollars and like trying to like, you know, buy all the Stones records and stuff. And it's great. But yeah, they're just kind of laying around. And it's hard to like imagine, like, my dad used to like listen to, you know, Goathead Soup or, you know, just sitting around and, you know, I guess. But I don't know. And
I actually have a lot of my dad's vinyl collection, and he wanted it back. I just took it, and I didn't even have a vinyl player. He was like, you want any of this stuff? I'm clearing it out. It's about ten years ago.
Yeah.
Sure, I'll take it. And then a few years ago, you know, during the lockdowns, he was bored, and he's like, hey, I'm getting a vinyl player. Can I have all my vinyl back? And I was like, no, I'm gonna keep it. Yeah. I would have given it back. But it's true though. It was a greater commitment until the last 5-10 years really of streaming. It was a greater commitment. And frankly, even when you were stealing stuff, I wasn't, but people were grabbing stuff on you know, the various.
Like Napster and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And then people would do that, and you know, they'd be playing a CD in their car when they're driving around, and you'd hear like the chat window from AOL Instant Messenger popping up in the middle of your song. And I'm like, what's that? Isn't that AOL? Like, well, yeah. So yeah, but I mean, even that was, you know, if you were to do that, I mean, over dial up, I can't even imagine. I never, I wasn't tech savvy enough to do it. You know, if I really wanted a CD, I'd go and buy it. But likewise. I can only imagine how long it took. You know, you tie up the phone line for like 5 hours just to get like a, you know, a, like Aerosmith Rocks. You know? Yeah.
Hopefully it wasn't a long distance call, because then it was probably would have been cheaper to go buy the CD.
it's a great point. So yeah, it's I don't know. It's great to be able to take in, you know, that much music and you know, have it around. And I don't know. My kids are 8 and 6, and so I just try and, you know, expose them to things. You know, my wife is all in on Taylor Swift. So my daughter's, you know, taking up that mantle, but I'm like, hey, here's a Rock and Roll All Night. Oh, I like that too. I'm like, great. You know, just let's like everything, you know,
with the kids thing, you know, so Brian and I have a 3-year-old, he just turned 3 a month ago. And he is a diehard U2 fan. Everything gets compared to U2. He's like, oh, I like this, but it's not as good as U2. This is almost as good as U2. Now, but he has broad knowledge, and it's pretty interesting, because a couple months ago, we take him to a weekly gymnastics class. Sure. And there's always a lot of music going. And one day he's singing along to Blitzkrieg Bop. And nice. And the coach says, hey, what song is this? And he goes, Blitzkrieg Bop. And he goes, oh, and parents are kind of looking around, you know, a dozen parents there. And they said, well, who sings this song? He goes, the Ramones. And everyone's like, whoa. So then he flips through, he grabs a Sinatra song, and he's like, well, who's this? And he goes, it's Frank Sinatra. And wow. Me and I are high-fiving each other. This is amazing. because we're giving, you know, we expose them to a lot of what we deem to be the classics. Could be modern classics, could be old classics, whatever it is, but really trying to train his ear. And he loves it, but he's even learned how to use our vinyl player. So he goes, pops a record on, you know, pulls the arm over, drops it, and gets going. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, I thought that that story was going to be like, this is Blitzkrieg Bop, and you know, it's okay, but, you know, it's no Rattle and Hum though. You know,
this was right before he started doing that. Oh. So give it another. If it had it been another week, yeah, he probably would have been along those lines. Now that would have been great. You know, I would love that. So
you know, it's interesting that he's only three, because it's like, I don't know if he'd be able to handle, you know, I've talked to people who've gone to that U2 show at the Sphere in Las Vegas. It sounds crazy. And look, I like that band. I'm not a huge fan, but I can only imagine, you know, how great that must be. I'm like, I don't know if a three-year-old could handle it, you know, talk about sensory overload, you know?
Well, that's, we've gone back and forth on it, because we've had opportunities to go, and we're going to not do it, because it, you know, by all accounts, they have a sensory overload room. You know, they have a detox room.
Wow.
So, you know, we'll wait. I'm hoping we're, you know, because I am a U2 fan. We are U2 fans that they'll go, you know, back out on the road sometime in the next year with the full band.
Yeah.
And at that point, we'll probably be able to get someone to help us out, to get us, you know, up on the stage or close to it. So make it worthwhile.
Yeah.
We've been tempted though.
Yeah, no, I know. And it seems crazy. And, you know, I know that those tickets for the Sphere aren't cheap. And I know they've got like Fish and then Dead and Company. I'm waiting for the band where the price tag makes me jump up and go, yes, I will pay that. But so far, I'm, you know, it hasn't necessarily been my scene, but I would love to definitely check it out if I were able to. It's so funny though, because yeah, kids, when they know stuff, they're, you know, my son doesn't have music knowledge like that, but he loves to read National Geographic kids books. So he's like, he presents a lot of facts, and I'm like, huh. And you look it up and you're like, he's actually right. You know, this obscure salamander that he's talking about really does exist, and it can only be found in, you know, it's like, it's almost like the kid in Jerry Maguire, if you remember that movie where he's got like all the facts and
that's right,
just sort of presenting them.
You have a little attorney on your hands there.
That's, you know what? That's a great point. Yeah. We'll learn all the legal precedents. So look, when you get a lot of press materials when you talk about a band, and you know, I wonder sometimes what the artists think about it, but yours stood out, because Sons of Silver, I'm going to read the exact quote, because I'm like, oh, this is a really cool description. Now, I don't know if anybody in the band came up with it, or if somebody that, you know, works with you, but it's described as classic rock and roll with an apocalyptic post-punk fury, harking back to the 60s and 70s when it was true protest music. And I'm like, that's pretty cool, you know, apocalyptic post-punk fury. Now, is that something that you guys think like, yeah, that describes us? Or is this the first time you're hearing it? Because sometimes I'll read things from the band notes to members of bands, and they're like, huh, that sounds pretty good. I'd like to see that band sometime.
Yeah, no, usually I see the press releases, or most of them, they cross my email just so I can make sure stuff's, you know, correct. But I don't necessarily recall that whole apocalyptic part. But then again, I do have a three-year-old who remembers everything, and who manages to not allow me to sleep, which erases my memory. So yes, it's possible I read that 5 minutes ago and just don't remember.
Right. No. Right before we came on, you had read it and you'd signed off on it, and now it doesn't sound familiar. Exactly. So if that's not how maybe you would describe Sons of Silver, how would you describe Sons of Silver?
Actually, I'm going to steal that one. That was pretty damn cool.
Okay.
So I'm going with that, you know.
So the album came out at the beginning of February, Runaway Emotions. And
if I may, it's just the first single from the album, the single, Tell Me This. Yeah.
Tell Me This is out, but the album is not out. My apologies.
Correct.
That's probably not the mistake of the press notes. I probably just didn't read it correctly. So, there is a video for the song that we're talking about. And I was explaining to Peter before we started that our video audience, you'll see the video, you won't hear it. Our audio audience will get to hear the song afterwards. And we talked a little bit about, you know, how, you know, very difficult it can be sometimes, that even when people are like, well, I own that music, so you can play it. And then you play it and you can get a strike from a record company or some publisher or something. That so it's always easier to not play music on YouTube. But I would love for people to check out Tell Me This, which is on your YouTube channel. And our visual audience is going to see that it looks really cool, you know, and talk a little bit. We'll talk about the song in a second. But while we're showing the video to people, I want you to just talk a little bit. I mean, I love the way that the screen is divided into five parts. And when it started, the band members were each in a different section. Talk a little bit about that vision. And does that make it take five times as long to film that there's five little mini screens?
It was a long, good question. Yeah, it was a long day to shoot. I think it was about a 14-hour day. And okay. And unfortunately for Mark, our drummer, he was nearly that whole time. Because we shot all the solo shots first, and his solo shot was first, and then we shot the group shots at the end. But nonetheless, it was entirely the concept of David Wolfgang, the producer, co-producer and director, and it was edited by his friend Sal Sclafani. And David is the husband to Brina, is one of Brina's closest friends. And we've been wanting to work together for a while. He's a TV and film producer and director, done a lot of really good stuff. And he just wanted to do music videos for us for a while. And then finally was the opportunity, you know, I brought him the song. He came back to me and said, okay, here's what I want to do. 60s mod colors, vertical. He wanted everything to be, you know, very vertically oriented, not just for the look of this video, but also so we could easily take clips and pop them over to, you know, Instagram, TikTok, and the likes of that, YouTube shorts. And it sounded cool. In fact, Brina had a similar vision, borrowing from a Dave Brubeck album in the 60s. And so we said, let's go for it. And I just showed up and did what he told me to do. You know, we brought our clothes. He selected the clothes, and that was it. It was David's vision entirely, and it's pretty cool.
Yeah, no, it definitely looks very cool. And if you are watching on YouTube, you're seeing it. And as soon as the video is over, you know, the algorithm might even suggest the video because you clicked on this one. But if not, you'll be able to just, you know, go type in "Tell Me This." Put in Sons of Silver, and your YouTube channel has videos for songs that were also done for the, you guys did a couple of EPs over the last few years before this full album, right?
Yeah. We did our very first EP, Doomsday Noises, came out 3 years ago. And then Ordinary Sex Appeal, which came out about a year and a half ago.
Yeah. Well, you've mentioned a few times that your wife is a keyboardist, and I guess she's been an engineer for the album. Talk about the rest of the band and how you got to know everyone.
Well, there's Adam Curry, our bassist, who's been my dear friend for a number of years now. He and I we first met when we formed a band called Last December, an LA band, which did really well.
And for the audience, this is Adam Curry with a K, not the guy who used to be on MTV.
That's correct.
Yeah, I always not that Adam Curry. Yeah, yeah.
It's not his doppelganger either. You know. But wow. So Adam and I met, and we had a pretty successful LA band, got gobbled up and chewed up and spit out by the major label system, you know, after we were very successful on our own.
Oh, you're the one band that happened to.
The one
unfortunately,
band,
the system shoots you up.
We reflect and we always think of the parody of it all, you know, the comedy of it all, that we just, you know, had a bit of Spinal Tap happen to us. But and then when we first formed the band, Dave Cruzan was our drummer, and Adam was playing in Candlebox with Dave Cruzan. Dave Cruzan being Pearl Jam 10, the original drummer for Pearl Jam. Dave brought in our guitarist, Kevin Holland, and Kevin's been with the band since the beginning, who's, you know, Kevin's dear friend now and integral part of the sound. Everyone is. And then, but Dave Cruzan left the band a couple years ago, and he's been replaced with Mark Sletsky. Mark's, you know, he was in the band Splendor several years ago, and quite a few years ago now. And Mark was actually introduced to us by John Fields, very fortunately. John Fields, a producer, engineer, mixer, who mixed our last EP, Ordinary Sex Appeal. And, you know, when we were in a pinch and looking for a new drummer, he brought up Mark as well as Isaac Carpenter, who also contributed a track on the album. And that's our lineup. We're all very close friends. It's not just a close musical lineup. We're all very close socially as well.
Yeah, and reading the background on Mark Sletsky is, you know, that I guess he's played with, you know, Third Eye Blind, Goo Goo Dolls, you know, obviously those are, you know, big 90s bands, but also Todd Rundgren. So, you know, getting to play with Todd means that, you know, I don't want to disparage the other bands I just mentioned, but
if I may to clarify that was one of those moments of press releases not quite being accurate. He opened for those acts, but he's played with Peter Murphy. Played with some other notable acts. I don't necessarily keep them off the top of my head because I'm bad at that stuff.
And he's actually,
because we have an off month and a half in March and April, he's actually going out with another notable act. So I won't mention that. I'll leave that to him.
But
busy man.
So, and in reading the notes now, it's almost like this press release is like the Wikipedia of Sons of Silver, where, you know, anybody can go in and update it, whether it's true or not. But my understanding is that the album kind of came about because, you know, during the pandemic, the lockdown phase, obviously the band couldn't play. So was that accurate that you weren't necessarily planning, like, right now we're going to make an album, but like so many musicians I've talked to really over the last 4 years, it's like, well, that's the only thing we can really do right now. So let's try and make music. Is that how these songs came about?
To a degree, that was especially true for our second EP, Ordinary Sex Appeal. Our first one came out in summer of 2020, and we Doomsday Noises, that is. And we were actually almost held it back. For a number of reasons. One, because, you know, God, it was just such a mess. And we were like, this stuff won't get heard. Secondly, because we couldn't tour to support it. So that was felt funky. And then third, actually, there was a song that we had on there called Outbreak, of all things, that was written recorded before, months before any of this even was, you know, on our radar. And so we decided, though, to release it. It actually charted really well for us, but again, we couldn't tour to support it on radio in particular, and that was pretty rough. And then Ordinary Sex Appeal, our second one, came about because we were genuinely locked at home. We had nothing else to do. Yeah. And so we just went to the studio, cut a new EP. And this current album that we finished, our first LP, first full length, that one, you know, was recorded in the wake. A lot of some of the songs were written, you know, at the tail end of the worst part of the pandemic. But the album was recorded in the wake of that. We began recording in the summer of 2022. And initially, we had planned to release just an EP. And it was going to be due in fall of 2022. But because of our drummer change, we had to, you know, scale back our schedule or push back our schedule a little bit. And then once we got into it, we realized we had more songs than an EP, and we thought we'd record two EPs worth, and ended up being one album. But those songs still pull from that time, that mindset a little bit. You know, it's this one though. We'll be able to go out and support on the road, which will make a big difference for us.
Yeah, no, definitely. And even so, one of the things that, you know, I keep going back to this press release and it makes me nervous, but it said that the band songs have collectively accumulated more than 9 million views and streams. And, you know, I know that 9 million streams and views and streams doesn't translate into, you know, the dollar amount of selling 9 million CDs 40 years ago, but I mean, by the current metric, it's like you can reach that many people. That's a great step. And if you're able to then also at the end of those videos or whatever, it's like, yeah, and see us out on tour. I think that that's kind of the next level. And that's sort of what I wanted to ask. So there's plans to tour in support of the album. And so only the song is out. Is there a release date for the album, or is that, you know, tell me this is there and then gradually there'll be a rollout, or is there a plan for a release date for the actual album?
Well, you know, it's a great question for us, you know, that we originally had planned to do two singles and then drop the album like May, June of this year. But, you know, this first single is doing really well. And I think we're rethinking the whole thing. And it looks like we're going to drop at least three or four singles, maybe even five before the full album. And each single will be between 6 and 8 weeks apart. And the reason being is just the nature of how the industry works, the business side of it works, and getting your material out there. It's much easier for the journalist, so to speak. And I use that in a really loose sense. You're a journalist, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, you know, I guess. Yeah.
How it's the same. It's easier for them to consume or to talk about a single than it is an album. So and it's easier for people who are just discovering us. For instance, we really never had much of a market in Europe, we thought, until the release of this single 2 weeks ago, Tell Me This, that is. And so we're finding it's blowing up over there. So we're getting contact European based labels who want to help us promote the album over there. So Or the singles in the album over there. Yeah. So we're kind of feeling it out. I've been saying, you know, summer, early summer of this year, 2024, that the album would drop, but now it may get pushed back to the fall.
Right. And I think that obviously you've got the material from the EPs, you've got the new stuff. So it's not like you can't already be out on the road and just sort of, you know, work off that. Is there a plan, or is it just like, yeah, well, we're going to play some shows and it's still getting put together? Because, you know, we're talking, it's the middle of February. So, you know, the summer, it's a long concert touring calendar between now and the summer, possibly.
Yeah, right now we're penciled in for as an opening act and a number of really cool tours. So we're sort of trying to help just choose which one we want to go with, you know, as well as they're trying to make their final decisions on us. Yeah. And so we're doing everything to make that optimum for everyone. You know, but everything looks really good. If it didn't, I'd tell you, but it looks really good. Our streaming numbers are really strong right now with this new release, and that definitely helps put us in a better position. So, you know, what I think is going to happen is once we get going, we're probably going to be out most of the year at that point. So be it we get rolling in May or June or July, once that happens, we'll probably finish out the whole year.
Right, exactly. And obviously, you know, I think a lot of bands, you know, will still hit the road and have sort of a you know, an established band and like direct support. But, you know, I like when there's sometimes it's somebody like you that I've interviewed and I'm like, oh, that band's, you know, on this bill. And, you know, I think that for bands, there's always that like, yeah, we're going to get in front of a big audience that probably doesn't know us. But you always have to be careful to not take one of those ones. You know, like before you and I started, we were talking about how I know the guys in the band Tesla, and they've done a number of tours where they've toured with variations of Def Leppard and Poison, and they go on first and they go on at 6:30 and they have like 33 minutes, you know, and it's like, cool, you get in front of a lot of people, but you know, it's there's also like, oh, people are still in traffic. People are parking their cars. So there's always sort of the balance of that. And
very true.
There's a young band called Classless Act, and I really wanted to see them. I went to what was called the Stadium Tour. So Def Leppard, Motley Crue, Joan Jett, Poison, and Classless Act. Classless Act literally went on at like 3:30. And it's at the football stadium. I'm like, I just couldn't get there. It was on a Saturday too. And I'm like, by the time I finally got in the venue, they had already played. So I was like, I wanted to see them. I just, you know, I just couldn't. So
that's a really important point. And often when you're, you know, green to this, you'll be like, oh yeah, we'll jump on that lineup, you know, for XYZ number of shows. and they say you're going to be an opener, and you think, okay, I'm opening for them. You don't realize that there may be four openers, and what you really want is direct support, which is the slot right before the main act. And then you have to know who's preceding you. Is it going to be an act that may just drive everyone to the, you know, beer lines, you know, right, for 30 minutes, and then by the time they come back in, you'll have finished most of your set. And then
is it going to be a guy with a banjo and an arrow on his head, you know?
Yeah, exactly. You know, or some band that, you know, will make you deaf in 5 minutes. So,
yeah.
it's a minefield navigating it. And yeah, it's not even necessarily that it's intentional on the parts of the other acts or their agents, managers, or the promoters and venues. It's just how it all comes together. It's these things tend to be a bit of a cluster, F-U-C-K, if I may.
Yeah. Well, you could, it's all right. You could have sworn. It's okay, but right, I appreciate it. I don't know if the three-year-old's in the other room, so it might be easier if you spell it out. But yeah, and you know, look, there's, you know, I used the Monkees Jimi Hendrix example, but a couple years ago, I talked to somebody who had written a book on Prince, and, you know, there's these infamous shows that the Rolling Stones did at the Coliseum, right, in L.A., and Prince was like booed off the stage essentially. And this, we're talking about Prince, you know, yeah. I mean, you know, this isn't Purple Rain Prince, but still, you know, he's one of the greatest performers of the 20th century. And he flew back to Minneapolis after the show and he didn't want to do the next show. And you're like, it just really depends, you know, like I saw Van Halen, I think Cool and the Gang opened. It can be a really weird mix, you know, so you have to be careful, because if it's say it's Van Halen, you'd be like, oh, that's, I mean, obviously not now, but this is the hypothetical, like, hey man, we get to open for Van Halen. Oh, but we're going on after Cool and the Gang, which, yeah, I'm not even disparaging Cool and the Gang.
No,
they're
great
at what they do, you, yeah, know, but it's like, that's not the crowd that you necessarily want to be there for.
It's very true.
You gave me an excuse to bring these tickets back up, because the Aerosmith show there on the right, the opening band was it was the Black Crowes at the Aerosmith.
Oh, wow.
Show. But this is Shake Your Moneymaker, Black Crowes. And, you know, so this is like literally seeing them for the first time. And there was definitely like, oh, this guy kind of moves like Mick Jagger.
Right.
We're seeing another guy who kind of moves like Mick Jagger. And I mean, they put on a good show, but I think I probably didn't appreciate it. Kiss had direct support from the band Slaughter, which in 1990 were like all over MTV. So, but it's funny, because like, if I try to think of bands that I saw open, you know, like I buy a ticket for somebody and then the opener, somebody I don't know, that I'm able to like, oh, I loved that band. It's been a really long time. You know, it's been, yeah, a while since, you know, especially because so many bands have, you know, they do like co-headline tours, you know, so it's like yeah. I saw Journey and Def Leppard a few years ago. There was another band. I actually don't remember who else was on that bill. I have no recollection of who the third band was. So apologies to whoever it was, you know, it could have been like Steve Miller or somebody, but I'm just like, I just don't remember sometimes, but
yeah.
Well, I hope you get on a big show where you're not playing at 3 o'clock, you know, and
no, it's seriously, we're going to choose right. And some of the offers that have come in have been really good. You would, at first you'd be like, really at first. And then you think about it for a second and you're like, oh, that would be good for us. And in fact, a couple of them, Adam Curry, our bassist, has toured or played some shows with them. And he's like, and when I mentioned the names, he's like, oh, that would be great. Or no, that he said, you'd think that would be good, but that wouldn't be good for us. You know, so he has some good experience there. But yeah, we'll be very, we'll scrutinize everything. We'll be judicious in how we choose things.
Right. And the band is still are you guys based in Southern California?
So, yeah, we're all here in LA.
I'll keep my eyes peeled because that means you'll be somewhere. I live in Burbank, so I can make it to.
We rehearse near you. You should come down to rehearsal. We rehearse at Mates in North Hollywood.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. That's North Hollywood. I've done interviews with people who were in, they're like, you know, you talk to them before they start. They're like, oh yeah, yeah, we're in a studio in North Hollywood. I'm like, oh yeah, where is it? I'm like, oh, I used to live a block from there. You know, there's so much rehearsal space and music, obviously, from back in the day. Well, Peter, I was planning on taking up a half hour of your time. We've talked for already 47 minutes. I could do it for 47 more, but I want to make sure that we hit the important thing. Sons of Silver, Runaway Emotions is coming out down the road. But Tell Me This is the song. Our audio audience is going to hear it right after we get done. And what are the best ways to keep in touch? Social media, website, any of that stuff?
Best way is just search Sons of Silver. They'll all pop up. Our website, sonsofsilver.com. Facebook is our, just Sons of Silver, like so on and so forth. DSPs, Sons of Silver. We always come up at the top because there is no one else with our name, fortunately.
That helps. Yeah. And there'll be times where I might be using the wrong example, but I was talking to George Lynch from Lynch Mob and Dokken, and I was going over his socials, and he was like, I'm on Instagram. I'm like, well, yeah, it says right here. He's like, huh, okay, I guess I'm on Instagram. So sometimes the band doesn't even know what all the socials are.
It's true. Yeah, no, we actually know. I helped set him up if I didn't set him up myself. I will admit I don't necessarily maintain all of them now. There's just too many things going on. We have our dear friend Alex Moreno, who was our tour manager while we were touring a lot right before the pandemic, but he's taken over that. But I do go on every day and oversee every post and make sure we're involved. So we're all involved.
Well, that is sort of the best thing about the current model obviously there's not the, big budget A&R departments at record labels like there used to be, but it's also like, oh, somebody really liked my video. I'm just going to say, hey, thanks for checking it out. And, that's not something that could have happened for any of the bands that I'm talking about seeing in 1990. I didn't get a message from Paul Stanley that said, thanks for coming to the show.
It's true. And I make sure to always sign stuff, or put my initials or Peter/SOS just so people know it's me. Cause someone's going out of their way to make a comment like that. I just want to say to you folks who are doing that, thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you for your thank yous and the likes of that. Now, some folks don't say nice things, but those are few and far between. But generally, it really means a lot. And it's just a little extra bit of a boost and encouragement, that we all seek. Even if you're Bono, you appreciate all that stuff. So
right, absolutely.
Please keep them coming, and I'll get back to you as often as I can, which is, daily.
Yeah, well, so look for Sons of Silver. Thank you so much for your time, Peter. I'm going to try. Peter Argyropoulos, or was I way off this time?
Touchdown.
Oh, my gosh, I did it. So really, that's what better ending could there be than that, except, of course, for our audio audience who is going to hear Tell Me This. Thanks again, Peter. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Christian. Look forward to doing it again, and it's been great.
Listening to The Bladcast. Don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel, The Bladcast. That's BLADTCAST. I'm Farad Muhammad, and if you want me to voice your podcast intro, you can find me at Twitter and Instagram at FARDMUHAMMAD. We will see you next time on The Bladcast.
Welcome to the party, pal!
Christian Blatt said that on my show. Christian Blatt's right. Never funny.
I like Christian, but you are
I
right.
I love Christian. Sir, how do you feel about doing a show co-hosted by Christian Blatt?
I don't know who Christian Blatt is, but I'm down.
All right, Christian, everybody else at Bladcast. I don't know what that is.
Naughty.
I like the idea that somewhere there's going to be people that are, fans of who are these broadcasters that are at a party where people don't know what that is. Mm-hmm. And they're like, hey, real quick, I'm going to put on Eric Zane and Christian Blatt.
Christian Blatt, I suspect, might be calling your mother, but not 100%. I mean, he did tweet something on Mother's Day. He tweeted something about moms, so I'm assuming that's what he meant. I would start looking into Christian Blatt. Blatt it. I don't know. Nobody knows how to say it.
Oh, yeah! It's the eye of the tiger. It's the thrill of the night. Rising up to the challenge of arrival.
Hello. I'm Conrad Bain.
Listen, you're a talker. About, no, you're like the worst broadcast ever.
Well, this has been the Blackcast. You can find me at Christian DMZ.
The Blackcast is 100% right.
The Bladfest, the Blad Cast.
The Bladcast.
One of the best podcasts you can ever see, the Blackcast. Whoop-dee-doo, we're watching it. We got no Wi-Fi. We can't hear a thing, but we love it.
Go watch the Blackcast.
Good luck with the whole thing. And, you know, here's to another 500. Get you to 1,000, you know, which is more than 500 last time I checked.
Totally forgot. I am doing the Blackcast tomorrow.
Goodbye, everybody. Goodbye.
We're closed.
That was not my fault.
I love Tukey.
Yay! Hacka, hacka!
I'm so excited!
Try anything you cancel, bro.
What are bells?
We'll see you next time on KissOnline.com and the Blackcast.